I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. President Trump tweeted early Saturday morning that President Obama had wiretapped his phones at Trump Tower and accused his predecessor of McCarthyism, calling him a bad or sick guy. Trump offered no evidence of his incendiary charge, which had been reported in Breitbart. Trump called for a congressional investigation, and his White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, added there will be no further comments from the White House on this issue. Meanwhile, FBI Director James Comey called on the Justice Department to refute President Trump's allegations that Obama ordered a wiretap of Trump's phones. So far, no response from Justice. We'll be talking about all of this and more with our guests later in the hour. Senator Chris Coons, Democrat from Delaware, is stopping by. Joining us now is John Brabender. He's a Republican consultant with Brabender Cox. He's worked with many Republicans, including Mike Pence, in his run for Indiana governor. And John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, very much enjoyed being here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Let me just give out a couple of phone numbers and some addresses to get folks in on the conversation. If you want to call or text us, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, it's never good when the first question involves a tweet coming from the White House on an early Saturday morning. Not good for the president or the Republicans. Is this a president who can't control himself?
Well, first of all, I think we should all get used to it by now, because this is how this president operates. And in some sense, although I've been very public in saying that I'm not supportive of him becoming sort of the tweeter-in-chief, that I don't think he should be doing that, there is some precedent for him having success doing this. What I think he has very much learned is that he can control a news cycle simply by a few characters that he writes and hits send. And I think that he is actually very careful when he does it from his perspective and in believing there is a reason that he wants to pivot, change the news cycle, or just simply bypass the sort of the mainstream press and get his word out there. So, to be honest, I think we're going to live with this for quite some time. I don't think this will be unusual in the future. I think we'll all get used to it.
But he's essentially accusing a former president of a crime. As I understand it, it's a crime for a president to order unilaterally the spying on an American citizen.
Yeah, well, first of all, I do think we have to put in perspective that this has become the status quo in Washington. I mean, we've already had two members of Congress already since Donald Trump has been sworn in. In fact, one, Maxine Waters, before Donald Trump even was sworn in, started to discuss whether we should think about impeachment. You know, so the divisiveness, the toxic nature, the constant political campaign nature in Washington is something that I think we see on both sides, and I don't think one side is more guilty than another. But with that said, I agree. I think these are serious charges. There is at least some documentation out there, some news reporting saying that there had been attempts by at least the Justice Department to try to get some surveillance on Trump Towers. We will find out if that's true or not. Indeed, if we do what Donald Trump says, let's make this part of the investigation, because there would have to be a paper trail of that. So, yes, these are serious allegations, and they're also allegations that can easily be proved or disproved. And I think that there's nothing wrong then if Donald Trump feels these are truthful, then we should investigate and we should get to the bottom of it and find out who's actually telling the truth.
But isn't it really the president's responsibility? He's the one that tweeted out these allegations. Isn't it the White House or the president's responsibility to offer that proof? My understanding is it comes from a right-wing radio host, and then it was picked up by Breitbart. We know that Breitbart certainly has some explaining to do when it's come to some of their other stories. But since he started it, isn't this the president's responsibility?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's not just limit this to Breitbart. There's been other people like Mark Levin and others who are conservative, and I get that. There has been a former attorney general, I believe, under Bush, who said that he believes there is some accuracy to what Trump is saying. We've even had some tweets by former members of the Obama administration that have made it clear. I believe one was one of his former speechwriters saying, you know, don't be too sure that there has that some of this doesn't have some truth to it. So one is I don't think it's necessarily incumbent upon the president to prove this any more than it's incumbent upon the Democrats to prove these allegations that the Russians somehow had some unique relationship with the Trump campaign. You know, yeah, I think the way you do this is you allow Congress to do this. You don't fight it out in the press where you have unnamed sources and so forth. You let members of Congress who are actively investigating all of these things. I think you do include this under that umbrella. And let's see if there's some truth to it or not. I think the American people deserve to know whether it's true or not. And I think you need a sort of an independent group, not the President Obama's campaign or group or President Trump's group or anybody else. I think it's got to be probably members of Congress.
If it is true, and it's apparently difficult to get a FISA warrant, you have to go through a bunch of various steps in order to get a warrant. If it is true, then it seems to undermine the president and some members of his administration that there haven't been some kind of either contacts or dealings, secret dealings with Russia and perhaps even the Putin administration.
Well, it's interesting because the reports, at least, say that they first went for the FISA in, I believe it was June, and were denied.
Right.
Which, in some sense, says, okay, maybe they were on a fishing expedition because it was denied. And so that does put the question forward, why was it denied? Why wasn't there enough information? Why were the Obama, or at least the Justice Department, trying? And then, supposedly, according to the news accounts, it was approved in October before just a few days or a few weeks before the election, which, again, I think says, why do you now wait and do this a few weeks before the election if that is the case? And does it still have the sense of a sort of fishing expedition? The other troubling thing that I find is that if you look at the New York Times reports of Russia interference and relationships with the Trump campaign, they had most notably been around reports of Paul Manafort having some unique relationship. Well, Paul Manafort was no longer with the campaign in October. So a lot of this is very confusing. A lot of this does sound a little bit like it could be somebody out there just trying to find something. And I think that's the concern on the Republican side. And again, Republicans would argue that this administration does have a little bit of history of this. We saw with the IRS that a number of conservative organizations were investigated, they believe, because of their politics, not because of their operations. And so there is always going to be suspicion in politics. And I think this is one case where there's going to be a paper trail and we're going to find out what the truth is.
But doesn't the president have a credibility problem going back to when he was one of the original and clearly the most outspoken birther? He made allegations that Ted Cruz's father could have had something to do with the assassination of President Kennedy. He talked about millions of people voting illegally. He said that President Obama founded ISIS. I mean, he has a paper trail of either misspeaking or exaggerating or withholding information or making outrageous and unsubstantiated claims.
Yeah, well, I mean, without doubt, Donald Trump says what comes into his mind. He doesn't have 12 political consultants focus grouping testing at first. And, you know, the irony of it, as a strategist, when that first happened, I thought this was going to be his undoing. Hmm. Like so many in the news media, like so many other professionals, we thought, well, you're never going to get elected president that way. And I got to be honest with you, I was wrong. And a lot of other people were wrong. And what we didn't realize is we kept looking at Trump instead of looking at the people who were voting for Trump. And what they were finding is even when he misspeaks from time to time, or even when he would say something that was in a tone or tenor that they would not say, they took that as a signal that he truly was going to be a different type of president. He was going to shake Washington up, and they could actually believe some of the things he said he was going to do. And that's what they were looking for. That's why I think a lot of Democrats are still shaking their heads saying, I don't understand what happened. How did we lose to Donald Trump? And it's, again, because they don't understand the frustrations that are happening, particularly in blue-collar America, places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, where you have a lot of people who feel like the American dream was snatched from them, that both parties let them down, that Washington is only about inside the Beltway and don't care about people outside the Beltway. And they saw Donald Trump in the way that he does message, whereas some people saw that as outside the mainstream of what you a presidential candidate do. Mm. They saw that as somebody that they could rally behind because they could believe him.
Well, I totally understand people's frustration with the political system, with the economic system, whether they're Republican or Democrat or anything else. You had mentioned Paul Manafort, but we can also talk about Michael Flynn, Jared Kushner, Carter Page, Roger Stone, and others. And let me ask you about Mike Pence. You worked with Mike Pence when he was running for governor of Indiana. Mike Pence was essentially left out of information, was not told that Michael Flynn and Jared Kushner, had met with the Russian ambassador. And there was, you know, your former client on television saying that there had been no contact when indeed there had been.
Right. And there were consequences for that. Flynn is now out because I think most people believe at the very least he was not totally forthcoming with Vice President Pence and possibly was not truthful with Vice President Pence. And therefore, he is out of the administration. I'm sure Mike Pence was probably very not just frustrated, but angry. I think most people that know Mike Pence, I think even people that haven't seen Mike Pence before him serving as VP, see him as a remarkably honorable man. And I think that, you know, he found that offensive. And I think that's why Flynn is out. And so, you know, there was a consequence. I think that was the right way to deal with that. But I will, you know, there's one other thing, too, that I still don't quite understand. And I've talked about this a lot on cable shows and so forth. I've been involved in probably five different presidential campaigns. I've done work in almost every single state, hundreds of statewide elections. And what I'm still perplexed at is, what do people think the Russians were capable of doing to help the Trump campaign? I mean, they say, well, they were having conversations with them. I don't care if they had five people in every strategy meeting. American strategists are more sophisticated. Our polling is better. What is it that people think you can't secretly put money into the system because the way everything is documented, every TV dollar that is purchased, the FEC knows about it. So I'm not even really sure I understand what people are implying that the Russians were even capable of doing during the campaign in communicating with.
Well, we know that they hacked the DNC. John, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Brabender. He's a Republican consultant with Brabender Cox, headquartered across the state in Pittsburgh. We are talking about what a lot of people are talking about this morning, President Trump's tweets and some of the pushback. We'll also be talking about some of the issues facing Congress and the White House. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with John Brabender. He's a Republican strategist. We're talking about the weekend's tweets and certainly what is facing the president and the Republican Party. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call or text us 267-405-2006. I wonder, John, whether President Trump is his own worst enemy. He got some high marks for his reading off the teleprompter, if I can say that, to the joint session of Congress, but basically staying on script. He seemed to have been thrown off by Attorney General Sessions' admission that he had met with the Russian ambassador two times. But it seems that he had, at least in his own world, a pretty good couple of days.
Yeah, I think he had a really good week last week, particularly the speech Tuesday night, and then the response to the speech. I think, you know, and even the polling numbers showed that most Americans agreed with what he said, and I thought they had some momentum. I think the one thing, if there's one piece of advice I'd give to this administration, is they got to make a transition from still being in campaign mode to being in administration mode. And I think sometimes instinctually, such as his tweets this weekend, would have made a lot of sense in the campaign, because in the campaign, you're always trying to make new news. In the administration, I think it's about owning a moment and then extending that moment out longer and longer when you can. And so I do agree that those are the type of things that I think the more that they get experience, because you do have a lot of people in this administration that this is their first administration.
Right.
When you come off a tough campaign, I think mentally it's hard to make that transition. I think they have to make that, and I think they will. I think they've improved. I mean, just by the way that we saw the way the speech was handled last Tuesday night, it's our understanding that a lot more people were involved in the development of that speech. It went through many drafts. Things were added, excluded at the end, and then it worked. The process worked, and I think they have to have more belief in the process of the administration and less concerning about day-to-day politics.
But what do you do about Trump's and his, President Trump and his Twitter account? And it is interesting that it seems to happen very early on Saturday morning. I don't know exactly know what to make of that, but that seems to be his Achilles heel.
Well, look, again, I sit there and say, how do you criticize a president, a person who basically changed how we do campaigns so dramatically that none of us thought he had a chance to win? And then he did. And now we're all going to be critical of his style when he sort of proved us wrong. With that said, I do believe there's a happy medium here. I think that it's not always about creating that moment where you're creating what the news is and that's all we're talking about. I think now what they got to do is put the politics aside. He's got a really robust agenda. I actually think they've done some great things so far. They have some accomplishments. They have some big hurdles this week, particularly on repealing and putting out a new plan to replace Obamacare. Very complicated, very difficult. I'd rather see them concentrate on sort of the agenda that they are laid out and making sure they're executing that. Forget about the noise that's out there. I mean, instinctually, they want to respond to every criticism, every complaint, any motivation by their enemies. And the truth of the matter is, they did win. And so it gives them the opportunity to govern now. They don't have to play politics anymore. And I do think they should concentrate fully on that, because these things become somewhat of a distraction, and I don't think it's helpful.
Several questions. One is, do you think 70-year-olds change? I'll just put that out there. And the other, it seems as if the president is learning a really hard lesson, which is that being the president of the United States is not like being a CEO. You have to deal with all these branches of power, of government, that can offset the power that he seems to enjoy.
Well, I'm kind of hoping the one skill set he does bring as CEO is, and he was very good at this, was bringing experts from a lot of different functions, business functions, listening to them, and then making decisions and moving forward. And I think actually the job of president these days is very much like a CEO, in that you have experts in the finance world, in the healthcare world, in national defense, and so forth. And it is about bringing in the best team, listening to them, and then making final decisions. And I think if he acts as a CEO that way and is very dependent upon some very good people that he brought in, I think that that's good for the country. I think it's good for his administration. And I think what you have to understand, though, the federal government is beyond any corporation size that he's dealt with. And I think he has to recognize that the size of this. The second thing is, as a CEO, though, the only people that you oftentimes have to worry about communicating to are customers,
right,
and also shareholders. I think what this president has to understand better is that he has to communicate to everyone. For example, when they do roll out their health care plan, I think it's very important that he personally talk to the American people about, here's what we're trying to accomplish. Here's what we want to give you assurances we're not going to change. And here's where we're going to work together to get this done. I think if they would have done that the first time on what's being called the Muslim ban, which I think is an inappropriate topic, if they would have first positioned that and say, look, we think there are seven countries that we worry about people coming in here. President Obama agreed with us and set those up as seven unique countries. All we want to do is to put for 30 days new things in place to monitor, to make sure that we are doing everything the right way to make Americans safe. Here's who we're not going to impact. But instead, they just put it out there and let others define what it was. And I do think he has to use his communication skills, not through his you know, phone, but rather talking directly to the American people more often and letting them know, here's what I'm going to do, why I'm going to do it. And I think that would be extremely helpful if they would take that tack.
John, we have to say goodbye, but just a correction. The Obama administration didn't have a refugee ban. They took a deeper look into people who were coming here, but there was never a ban put out by the Obama administration.
No, but those were the specific countries that they picked, which everybody said this was universal to Muslims. Why? No, it wasn't. It was a small handful of countries with dense Muslim populations. But it was just following the precedent of these specific countries that were set by the Obama administration. It wasn't like it was new countries that this president happened to select. And I think that was lost on a lot of people.
Well, we have to end on that note. John Brabender, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you with us. And again, he was joining us from across the state, from the Pittsburgh area, Republican consultant with Brabender Cox. Well, joining us now is Delaware Senator Chris Coons to talk more about President Trump's Twitter storm over the weekend, accusing President Obama of spying on him, ordering wiretaps of phones at Trump Tower during the presidential campaign. Now, according to the New York Times, this incendiary allegation began with a conspiratorial rant by a right-wing talk radio host that was picked up by Breitbart News. On the table for our discussion are these tweets, I should say, investigation into Russian ties with Trump and his team, the fate of the Affordable Care Act, the travel ban, Trump's nominee to sit on the Supreme Court, and how the Democrats are trying to rebuild their party. And Senator Coons joining us, sitting across from me. They just snuck him in here. He's a member of the Appropriations, Foreign Relations, Judiciary, Small Business and Entrepreneurship and Ethics Committees in the Senate. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back with you, Marty.
So I'll start where everyone else starts. What do you make of all those tweets that came out? And the charges, I don't want to make light of this. These were charges that the previous president essentially broke the law or certainly used the law for nefarious reasons.
Marty, these are shocking allegations. And let's just put this in context for a minute. I'm here in Philadelphia today, obviously partly to be with you, but also earlier today we had a meeting over at Drexel of the CEO Council for Growth, Select Greater Philadelphia. We had senators and congressmen from all three states, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, to meet with dozens of CEOs of hospitals, universities, big employers. And their focus was on rebuilding our infrastructure, trying to grow manufacturing jobs, improving health care. And I got pulled out to give a quote to a national TV network about Donald Trump's tweets. He is the distractor in chief. He gave a relatively focused and on-message speech last week to the Senate and then was allegedly, in press reports, enraged by Sessions, former senator, now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, being the dominant face in the news the next 2 days as he was forced to recuse himself from the ongoing investigation into collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians because he was untruthful to the Judiciary Committee. And then the president engages in this tweet storm, accusing the former president of doing something that is either completely unprecedented and outrageous, if true,
right,
or another of President Trump's long record of utterly baseless allegations. I'll remind you, he really led the birther movement without a shred of evidence. Right after being elected, he claimed that millions of people voted illegally and demanded an investigation. And even this Republican Congress, quite enthusiastic about investigating things, hasn't taken him up on it yet because there's no evidence.
Is he unfit to be president?
I'm increasingly concerned that President Trump's credibility domestically and globally is being undermined by his repeat practice of focusing on an important issue of governing and then veering off onto some fight. I mean, he dedicated almost equal time to fighting with Arnold Schwarzenegger about why Celebrity Apprentice was being canceled as he did to these alarming accusations about his predecessor. I can't remember in my lifetime having a sitting U.S. president accusing his predecessor president of violating the law and the Constitution and then offering no proof.
Well, and what he's saying is we're going to say nothing more. This is from Trump and also from his White House, Sean Spicer, basically putting it on Congress, on obviously the Republican-controlled Congress, to deal with this. They will say nothing more. Can Congress force the White House to be more disclosing?
Well, our challenge, as you point out, Marty, is that it's a majority Republican Congress that hasn't stepped up to challenging this president to disclose things. I'll give you one example. There is a statute under which the Finance Committee of the House and Senate could compel the disclosure of Donald Trump's taxes, not to the general public, but to a closed review by those committees. And the House Ways and Means Committee, on a party line vote, declined to exercise its power to do that. Why is this relevant? Well, first, every president for decades has disclosed their taxes. I think every major party political candidate. And this president hasn't disclosed his potential conflicts of interest. The ongoing issue with Russia is a grave concern. Russia's our adversary. Republicans and Democrats have different policy views, different priorities, but we're not actually enemies. And in order to try and elevate this discussion, last week I did a joint floor speech with Senator Rubio of Florida, conservative Republican. We both got elected in 2010. He's on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's part of this important committee charged with getting to the bottom of all this. And I think it's valuable to have a Republican and Democrat on the Senate floor saying, as Rubio did at the end of his speech, I won't be part of a witch hunt, but I won't be part of a cover-up, and we're going to go get to the bottom of this. This week, I'm trying to do the same thing with Senator Cotton of Arkansas. We just discussed it yesterday. It's important for us to get the partisanship out of this investigation, to focus on our national interest, and to move forward. Only the Senate Intelligence Committee at this point has the ability and the opportunity to see the raw intelligence that's been collected, to sift through it, to reach a conclusion, and to then help move us forward.
You mentioned Russia. I want to play a clip. This was from Friday. You were interviewed by Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC about possible transcripts that could provide insights into whether Russia worked with President Trump to influence the election. Let's give it a listen. I'll give you a chance to respond. Do we have that there? RT06 Coons? No. Well, you did say that.
Well, let me speak to that, Marty. What I was trying to clarify in that interview was that members of the administration and Republican leaders who say there's no there there, we don't need to continue to investigate all this, are trying to either stonewall or deflect focus from the real issue, which is the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee need to get access to what intelligence has been gathered. I didn't say I know there are transcripts that prove collusion between the Trump campaign and Russians. I said instead our intelligence services have collected relevant information. I'll remind you of the context. This was last week before it became clear that the Senate Intelligence Committee would this week be given access to the raw intelligence. We'll see how it goes. The Attorney General has now recused himself, and tomorrow, Tuesday, the Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a confirmation hearing for the gentleman who's been nominated to be number two at the Department of Justice and thus would be the person responsible either for naming a special prosecutor or for making any decisions going forward about the FBI investigation.
But do you think there is incriminating information? Are you saying we just don't know?
But it's our job to make sure that it's not stonewalled, that it's not blocked, and that there is access to the intercepts and transcripts that the intelligence community has.
But you did tell Andrew Mitchell that you did believe they existed.
They, intercepts and transcripts. So the point I was making there was you can't just wave your hands and say there's nothing there. We don't know what information is there, what it says, what the conclusion is. So let this investigation go to its natural conclusion. Let me speak to one other point briefly, if I could, Marty. John, who was the guest before me,
John Brabander,
said a number of times, well, why does it matter? How could the Russians have possibly helped Why is this relevant? Right? A dozen senior members of the Trump campaign have met with the Russian ambassador. Maybe they met with Russian spies. Maybe they met with who cares? Well, I'll tell you that there is public evidence that there was an intentional campaign by the Russians to first generate fake news and to employ hundreds of people in Russia to influence what sort of search results you got in particular states in a targeted way to influence choices and information. And second, the more important one is, as we all know, the DNC was hacked. A huge body of emails were mined. They were then selectively leaked. And I'll remind you of one fact. The Access Hollywood tape, a tape in which now President Trump was recorded saying shocking, offensive things. That tape came out, and no more than a day later, the whole dump of the John Podesta emails came out, changing the subject and focus of the electorate and the press. Was that completely uncoordinated? Was that purely accidental? This is one of the things that Russia could have done to be enormously helpful to the Trump campaign.
Was there, from what you know, any tampering with voting machines? Because that was an allegation that was out there for a while.
I'm not aware.
Up in a break, but go ahead.
I'm not aware of any proof that there was actual impact on voting machines. But I'll remind you, the importance of this investigation, it's not just about the last election. It's about our next election. It's now clear to the world how an open society like ours can and might be in the future deeply influenced by a well-financed, focused effort by an adversary. And in recent meetings with the French ambassador and German ambassador, they've spoken about how concerned they are about ongoing Russian interference in their upcoming elections this year.
That is Senator Chris Coons, Delaware Democrat, joining us today on Radio Times to talk about a whole host of things. You can join our conversation, radiotimes at whyy.org. I'll read a bunch of tweets. We've been talking about this for the last 40 minutes or so. You can also send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can call or text us, 267-405-2006. We're interested in your reaction to President Trump's tweets over the weekend. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Senator Chris Coons, a Delaware Democrat, a member of the Appropriations, Foreign Relations, Judiciary, Small Business and Entrepreneurship and Ethics Committees in the Senate. Let me read just a bunch of email comments and tweet comments that we've got here. Trump is beyond destructive. When will the GOP respond and condemn this behavior? An email from ED with Trump's wildly disturbing fact-free accusations. This isn't a presidency. A tweet from Kim. This is just Trump changing the conversation about Sessions lying about Russian contacts. A tweet from Joe. If this continues, then POTUS can make any claim and Congress will have to chase it ad infinitum. Let me just pick up on that. And you kind of referenced this earlier, Senator Coons, which is you were here at a meeting to have a substantive discussion. And here we are talking about tweets. Do you see this as the president distracting from some of the problems he has, whether with the attorney general or just being dogged by these allegations of Russian ties?
Donald Trump was an unusual candidate for president, and he was successful in his campaign, in part by often grabbing the wheel and jerking it sort of right or left as the presidential primaries moved along. I'll remind you, he made the wild and baseless accusation that Senator Rubio's father was somehow involved in the assassination of JFK.
Outrageous.
I mean, it's easy to forget because this was months and months ago, but week after week, he lurched from accusation that was often groundless. And I had thought, and many had thought, that the weight and the significance of the office of the president would force him to begin to focus, that perhaps people on his staff would take the phone away and disconnect his Twitter account so we wouldn't see these 3 a.m. Twitter fights. Instead, he continues, and it's a destructive and distracting practice.
Just a quick correction. It was Ted Cruz's father, not Rubio's.
But Ted Cruz. You're
that's
right.
Okay.
You're
yeah,
right.
We mentioned this actually earlier in the hour before you were here. Let me ask you, though, about contacts with the Russians. I saw one of President Trump's tweets, which is that the president invited the Russian ambassador to the White House numerous times. Other members of Congress, whether Republican or Democrat, have met with the Russian ambassador, other members of Russia, Russian leaders. Is there anything wrong with meeting with Russians?
Of course not. There's nothing wrong with meeting with a Russian ambassador. But let's be clear. I'm on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and have been. I'm in my seventh year. I've only met the Russian ambassador once, to the best of my memory.
Did you shake his hand?
We were in a very large group meeting to talk about the Iran deal. There were three ambassadors present, and there were, I think, a dozen or maybe two dozen senators present. I have met the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, who just recently passed away, twice for one-on-one meetings. I remember those meetings. They don't happen every day. They don't happen every week. And what's important here is that Trump's former national security advisor, General Flynn, has now been forced to resign because he lied about his meetings, his contacts with senior Russian officials. And former Senator Sessions, now Attorney General Sessions, was asked directly in his confirmation hearing to speak to any contacts with Russians. And he said, no, I didn't meet with senior Russian officials.
Did he lie?
He was under oath, and he certainly misspoke. Whether it's perjury requires some consideration of whether this was intentional or not. That's why I've called for the Attorney General to come back to the Senate Judiciary Committee, answer questions in full, and try to clear the air on this. Otherwise, I think it undermines his credibility as Attorney General to have so clearly – if you just look at a transcript of what he was asked and what he answered, it was not truthful.
Are you saying that recusal and Sessions said he would recuse himself if it involved the campaign in Russia, that that's not enough?
That's a positive step. It's important that the general public, you know, both supporters and opponents of President Trump, have confidence that the investigation that's ongoing gets to the bottom of it. My core concerns are whether he is actually effectively and thoroughly recusing himself from investigations that in any way relate to collusion between the Trump administration or campaign and Russia, and that we have a full and fair investigation. But I do think that the Attorney General should return to the Judiciary Committee and answer questions, not just send us a brief written explanation.
What if he does not?
Well,
what authority do you have to force him to do that, or do you?
We have no authority. Speaking as a Democrat in the minority on the Judiciary Committee, I can't compel him to do anything. And that's one of our core challenges, is that if the Republican majority of each of these committees, the Intelligence Committee, the Armed Services Committee, Foreign Relations, Judiciary, if Republicans don't step up and challenge some of these actions and some of these statements, they'll be able to continue working along with the administration and, frankly, bury or stonewall this investigation. So it's critical to work with Republicans to help them recognize the centrality of this investigation to the rule of law, to the respect for our democracy, and to our future.
Is there a way that the Democrats, again, in the minority party, could say, well, we're not going to either vote on Gorsuch or some kind of negotiation to say that we won't do this if you won't do that? You looked at me with a funny look on your face.
Senator Schumer, who's our minority leader, who's the leader of the Democratic caucus, is regularly negotiating with Majority Leader McConnell over what we are willing to do or not do to shut down the government or shut down the Senate. We've had, as you saw, a number of fairly bitter fights over confirmation. We are weeks farther into this administration without the full cabinet confirmed than has happened in a long time. That's largely because President Trump nominated a series of billionaires who hadn't done their tax disclosures or their Office of Government Ethics disclosures. It's partly because he nominated people to the cabinet who were determined to destroy the very agencies or who had records that were suggestive that their main goal was to undermine the very agencies they were nominated to run. So we have had a series of fights over confirmation. I leave it to Senator Schumer to make decisions about how far. One of our challenges is we're Democrats. We don't want to shut down the government. We actually think the government overall does good things for the American people. When Senator Cruz led a successful effort to shut down the government of the United States for 17 days, thousands of federal agencies and offices and functions shut down for several weeks. I heard very loudly and clearly from the people of Delaware, they don't want us to do that. That's our ultimate card, is to threaten to shut down the government when we get to the end of the funding that's coming up fairly soon, the end of the continuing resolution. But that's really the only card we've got.
You sit on the Judiciary Committee. What kind of questions do you want to ask Neil Gorsuch?
Judge Gorsuch of the 10th Circuit, who's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, won't answer the questions I most want him to answer.
Such as?
Do you believe in a right to privacy? Do you think Roe versus Wade was well and soundly decided? And will you vote to overturn it? That's a question he won't answer.
Is that a legitimate question, though, to come from the Senate?
We have a practice. We have a practice in the Senate Judiciary Committee of judges have observed this over a number of confirmation hearings of having them not answer a question on a case that they may soon decide may rule. It's a well-settled case, a well-settled approach to confirmation hearings, and it avoids our confirmation hearings becoming simple checklists of, I want someone who will overturn Citizens United and someone who will respect and preserve Roe versus Wade, whereas, perhaps another senator, Senator Toomey, might want the reverse. In a debate, both Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump were asked, what are you looking for in a Supreme Court justice? Both of them gave a checklist answer. I want uphold this, overturn that, uphold this, overturn that. What I am asking Judge Gorsuch and what I think is an appropriate question and what I wish they had answered in that debate is instead, what's your view of the Constitution? Why is originalism and textualism as an interpretive approach the right approach? Do you believe the Constitution in any way evolves? So is the right to privacy in a world where we all have smartphones that are quite different from the desks in which colonial citizens here in Philadelphia kept their papers? Does it matter as we interpret the Fourth Amendment right to unreasonable search and seizure? Does the fact that technology has emerged and evolved dramatically since the Founders' Day matter? Or can you really actually interpret and apply the Constitution by hauling out a dusty old 1790s dictionary and get a sense of exactly what these words meant when the Constitution was drafted? He is an originalist. He's a conservative. He hasn't said things that make it yet clear really where he comes down on these core issues. And so we are in the meetings we've had, and we are meeting again tomorrow, spending time talking about cases he has actually decided. He can and should answer questions I have about the cases he has actually decided, like Hobby Lobby, like many others, where he has typically sided with corporations over people and with more powerful and moneyed interests over plaintiffs and litigants who are less advantaged. And I'm concerned and curious about how he reached a number of his important decisions.
Let me ask you about the Democratic Party. There's a new head of the party after an interesting and I think close vote for a while. And as we know, under the Obama administration, the Democratic Party lost, I think, hundreds, maybe even 1,000 seats when you add up the federal government, state and local government lost under President Obama. How do you rebuild a party? And does it become the party of Bernie Sanders? Has it become the party of what's left over of Hillary Clinton?
The Democratic Party needs to be rebuilt one state at a time, one county at a time, one municipality at a time, one precinct at a time. In Delaware, just two weekends ago, we had a decisive special election. Folks today think of Delaware as a deep blue state. It's not. It's a state where two out of three counties of vote majority Republican voted for Donald Trump for president, and where there is a range of views politically. And our state Senate was evenly divided. And so the election we had two weekends ago determined control of the state Senate, which thus determines the likely trajectory of our new Democratic governor, John Carney, and his ability to work with the General Assembly to enact his priorities.
It's gerrymandering, isn't it?
So it was won by the Democratic candidate, and not by a little, by a lot. And by a lot because we saw a new flood of volunteers, of contributions, of engagement. The same thing happened in the past week in Connecticut in a special election. We need to rebuild the Democratic Party state by state and nationwide. We have seen a dramatic loss in state and local elected officials and infrastructure. We haven't been in this weak a position since 1920 as a party.
Almost 100 years then.
And that's worth really focusing on because we got shellacked in the last redistricting after the last census. If we want a competitive House, where out of 435 seats, there are dozens and dozens of competitive seats, then we need a more successful open redistricting process. That requires more Democrats at the table as redistricting is done after the 2020 census.
But it's so interesting when you see, I mean, I'm looking at all the negative comments about President Trump, but there's obviously a whole other side of the country that is very much in favor of what this president is doing.
Of course, there were pro-Trump rallies around the country this past weekend, just as there have been many and frankly much larger anti-Trump rallies in the months since he became president. One of our challenges is speaking to the folks who voted for Trump but who were lifelong Democrats, or voted for Trump but hadn't been voters before, hadn't been active in voting before. The Democratic Party got away from our FDR-era focus on working Americans, on the impact of deindustrialization, the loss of jobs, the loss of opportunity and hope and a sense of security. And we have to step up. We have to step up and deliver ideas, programs, initiatives that'll connect with folks and work with folks. Some of what happened in the last election was unique, specific to the candidates, to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But some of it reflects a decade-long slide away from our engaging with and speaking to folks who are worried about our economy and our future and our values.
Let me play a comment from Emily. Emily, who called into our comment line.
Hi, my name's Emily. I'm calling from Philadelphia, and I'm calling to comment that we can't change how President Trump tweets, and I agree that he is distracting from other issues, but the media can change how they cover it, and I'm really looking forward to NPR taking initiatives to actually report on the issues at hand, such as bills in Congress.
Fair enough. I think it's more directed to me, perhaps, than to you. And we will continue. I think NPR continues to cover both the Twitter storm over the weekend, but also the issues facing, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or deregulation and all of that.
I mean, this week we will see a new travel ban by the president. We will likely see the House Republicans finally disclose their plan for the repeal and replacement of the ACA. And we are likely to soon see movement on the budget. The president, his folks are proposing deep, deep cuts into foreign aid, the State Department, into the EPA, its ability to protect us, our clean air and clean water. If the president really does propose $54 billion in new spending on defense, his only way to offset it is likely profound across-the-board cuts to a whole series of things vital to our health, to our safety, and to our progress as a country. We should be talking about that.
But the other way is just to let the debt go up, right? You can just add to the debt.
Republicans in the House are not going to let him increase spending on defense by $54 billion without offsetting cuts. He has said he won't touch entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. The only other place to go is domestic discretionary spending, which as a percentage of our total federal budget is soon to be at the lowest level since the 1960s. We've already cut it through sequestration. So I think the question has to be, why $54 billion in additional defense spending? And if you want to do that, raise the revenue to pay for it. Don't cut investment in medical research, in education, in infrastructure. He wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Where the heck is that coming from? And this goes back to a basic point. Donald Trump doesn't follow most Republican Party positions, whether it's on trade, on the deficit, or on spending priorities. And so they're going to have a real challenge putting together plans and the path forward for governing that works. He hasn't transitioned from campaigning to governing, and it's about time for him to do so.
You think he's a bigger problem for the Republicans than the Democrats? We're literally
Look, Marty, he's a challenge for all of us.
On that note, Senator Chris Coons, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Again, Delaware Senator Chris Coons, our second guest, the first guest, John Brabender, a Republican consultant, talking about a whole host of things over the course of this hour. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. Thanks for joining us.